All right, everyone. Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, and this is episode number 45. And with me today is Ben Fennell. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Matt. I think we're long overdue to get together here.
Yeah, absolutely we are. And if you don't know Ben on Twitter, you should get to know him. He's, you know, I'll just read his kind of, you know, basically his resume here. You know, he's been a contributor at The Athletic Wisconsin. He does a lot of NFL draft work with NFL Network, you know, Eagles game plan, as well as in-game X and O's for ESPN College Football. So, you know, Ben, tell me a little bit about the gig that you get with the NFL Network, since this show is, you know, focused so much on player evaluation of college prospects.
Yeah, it's kind of a wordy business card when you read all the jobs off at once like that. But so it's my fifth season hopping over to NFL Films to help out with all their offseason coverage. So that's the Senior Bowl, the Combine, the draft primarily. I was really close with Mike Mayock in my previous stint in NFL Films when I worked for the show Playbook on NFL Network for 5 or 6 seasons. I got really close with Mayock, and as he needed someone to help out with his draft research and draft coverage, we had a good relationship and a good friendship, and he brought me back over about 5 years ago. Now wishing him the best as the general manager of the Oakland Raiders, and I'm working closer with Daniel Jeremiah, Charles Davis, and some of the other analysts on NFL Network. So it's really just working in tandem with those analysts and just trying to come up with the right video representations for all their notes on these draft prospects. So when they go to the Senior Bowl or the Combine or the draft and they have pros and cons of the prospects, it's my job then go dig through all the footage and try to find the plays that represent those traits on those prospects so they can talk about them. And, you know, it's more analytical stuff. It's more player evaluation stuff, but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of football. It's a lot of X's and O's, but, you know, life could be worse, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, I laugh because I think of who would be someone that I would probably say people go, oh, he's living the life. And I would say anyone, any football fan whose job for a living is to watch the game, and you get to dig that up for a great cast of people. I'm a big fan of Charles Davis, and obviously Daniel Jeremiah does some great work, and to have a chance to be able to work with guys like Mike Mayock is, you know, I can imagine has been an absolutely, you know, a fantastic experience for you.
And those are just people that are so willing to give back as well. And they understood that they didn't get to where they were on their own. And they're really willing to, you know, take some younger people under their wings, teach them the kind of inside tools of the trade and how to watch film and the things that they've learned over the years. And they couldn't be nicer human beings. And the things that I've learned from all the people here at NFL Films, like those guys, Brian Baldinger, Matt Millens of the world, Mike Lombardi, Charlie Casserly, just really great to see these older generation guys giving back to the younger people like me and not afraid to kind of teach me the way.
That's awesome. You know, it's funny that you mentioned Matt Millen, because I know, you know, publicly a lot of people think about his work as a GM and how that didn't work out very well. But, you know, I've heard from some people inside the league who worked with him or who worked around him that he is probably one of the most genuine, nicest people that they've met.
Honestly, one of the nicest human beings I've ever met, and I have a huge, huge, huge man crush on Matt Millen. He's just such a cool, normal guy. And anybody that has a bad thing to say about Matt Millen, I usually follow that up with, that means you probably don't know Matt Millen. And Obviously the media blitz he took for all his clunky picks in Detroit, that's kind of gotten pushed to the forefront, and everybody forgets, you know, he was a 4-time Super Bowl winner, All-American at Penn State, played for, you know, 12 years in the NFL. And he's very candid about his experiences with Detroit and says exactly where he went wrong and what he wasn't prepared for. And he takes a lot of ownership, and I really respect him as a person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's just fantastic stuff. I remember watching him play. I mean, I was a huge fan of him as a linebacker, and I remember him as an analyst on television before he got that. And he was one of my absolute favorite play-by-play analysts. You know, he and Chris Spielman, I don't know, there's something about linebackers doing doing that gig that I'm drawn to. But you know, you talked about All-Star game practices. You know, we got the Senior Bowl coming up next week. You know, in addition to, just because it's the nature of your job, in addition to that, how do you prepare for these types of practices? How do you value them? And, you know, what might be overrated or underrated to the way you look at these practice weeks?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of eyeballs on this process right now as the Shrine Games being held right now. The NFLPA game is also this week, Senior Bowl next week. But at this point in the process for teams and scouts, 95% of your work is done. Right. And you've already, you know, gone through all the school visits. And you've, so when you go to the school visits, especially the bigger schools, you're getting put through the car wash and you're going to meet with your academic advisors. You're going to meet with the position coaches. You're going to meet with the strength and conditioning coaches and try to figure out everything about the player around the player, because you really don't get one-on-one time with the player. So showing up to these all-star practices, it's about 5% of the evaluation. If you get one-on-one time with the player, that's great. That's something you couldn't get done during the season. So if you already saw them in person, great. If you didn't see them in person, this is an opportunity to see their body type, to see how their weight is distributed, how their weight is proportioned. Can they add weight to their frame? What's their flexibility look like? And what's so overrated in these week of practices are the results. You really need to value the process of this because, you know, the quarterback receiver timing is off. They haven't worked together. And that's the same for the offensive line. It's the same for the coverages and the communications and the gap fits from the D line and the linebackers. So what you're really looking for is just the work ethic, the attentiveness, your hustling between drills, your attitude, how you respond to coaching. Because those coachability questions, you really don't know until you get your hands on the kid. You want to see how they respond to things that maybe they've never done before, or a technique that they've never been asked to do in college. So it's a lot of the aesthetics of the week and not necessarily the results that you're putting a lot of the value in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with all of that, because it's fascinating to me watching some of these practices. To me, it's often about how quickly they learn. You know, I want to see them set a baseline and on the first day or two, see what they're getting coached on. If I get the opportunity to be able to notice that and make note of it and see how they perform in the subsequent days, or if someone's, you know, did some impressive work within a certain practice session, what was it about that session that was taught to the test? How much of it was something that really is realistic that what you'd see on the field? And then when they change that up, and they may, you know, a good example was a guy like Nick Vinette a few years ago, the tight end of Ohio State with the Seattle Seahawks. You know, you'd hear some people talk and you would think that he was like the next Rob Gronkowski because of the way that he was catching balls and drills. And it's like, well, that's great. But, you know, he's facing the drills basically set up for him to get open. Now what happens when he gets pressed? Can he maintain concentration in those situations? I hadn't seen on film. So some of the part of that is, again, yeah, watching the film and saying, what are some things that if you happen upon them in practice that you'd like to see that you didn't see on the film that practice might show you? And usually that list is very small, and it's not for every player. It might be one thing for like one out of every 10 players, and you might actually see that one thing.
Yeah, so, a lot of times you're just making that note when you see something in practice to maybe go back to your notes or go back to the film and just double check an area. And maybe a player looked more explosive than you gave him credit for, or maybe you saw a player struggle with catching that you maybe didn't see before. But what you don't know when you're watching these practices. It may be a tackle that vertical set his entire career, and all of a sudden he's taking normal kick slides. Or a tackle moved into guard. And it's the same way. I don't want anybody evaluating me at the driving range. You don't know what I'm working on. You don't know what's new. You don't know if I change my grip, my stance, if I have a sore muscle. Nobody should really be evaluated for the results at practice. And I like to refer to the driving range. You should never evaluate a golfer at the driving range because you don't know what they're working on.
That's exactly it. I mean, you think about Tom Brady, and Tom Brady in practice is oftentimes testing out different types of routes in different coverage looks or in the red zone in a situation and seeing if maybe he could fit it in there. Maybe he could try and throw it to a certain area of the field. And he's testing the limits of what he can and can't do to see whether or not it makes sense to try in a game. You know, so he's going to make mistakes. And that's and good practice is about making mistakes.
All over social media during these weeks, and they're exciting. They're fun. It's interesting, you know, visuals to see one-on-ones and players not in pads. It's just different for the public. But you need to understand you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. So now that you and I are now officially brothers in arms in the Wet Blanket Society for all social media for these things. Let's go move on to just the draft in general. And And which positions do you think are particularly strong in this draft class based on the research you've been doing?
Yeah, you know, every draft has personality. Every draft has trends. You're not going to get the same, you know, type of top-heavy positions. And there aren't Hall of Famers in every draft class. It's just not, you know, how the process of finding prospects goes. But as far as the 2019 draft class, I'm seeing a very, very strong lean towards the defensive side of the ball. I see edge rushers in all different shapes and sizes and different ways to win. I see it being very top heavy with the sexy names like Nick Bosa and Brian Burns and Ja'Kai Polite and Josh Sweat, Josh Allen. But then there's the mid-round guys as well that are very productive in school. The Landis Durhams of the world from Texas A&M who have had double-digit sack years, or Sutton Smith or Max Crosby, you know, at a level just below D1. And then some small school guys like Marcus Jones, who's having a great week at the Shrine game. He's from Angelo State. And, you know, he's a Gene Upshaw Award winner. He had 15 sacks this year. I just feel like there's edge rushers kind of at every level of the draft, and every NFL team wants quarterback hunters to help their defense.
Nice. So on the opposite side of that, are there any positions that you just feel like aren't that strong as a group, that you're looking at and saying, okay, maybe there's some guys that, you know, there might be one or two guys that are a headliner that gives it some a marquee name, but overall it may not have that kind of, you know, density of skill across the board.
Yeah, certainly. And just going back to the strong positions, like I was just mentioning edge, obviously interior D-line, but then the linebacker and safety groups seem to be getting deeper and deeper in these drafts. Everyone wants linebackers that can run and safeties that can cover. It's a lot of interesting safeties that can cover this year, whether it's the Delaware kid, Nasir Adderley, Darnell Savage down in Maryland, Chauncey Gardner at Florida. Everybody wants that guy that can kind of wear multiple hats on that defense. But the weak positions, I look at the offensive side of the ball, and every year you're not going to get these deep groups of skilled players. And I just don't see it being a very deep group at the running back, receiver, quarterback, tight end positions. And I know those are the marquee positions that you think, how could they not be deep? There's all these yardages getting put up in college football. Fantasy football is, you know, a big deal. It's going to be receivers every year. I just don't see it being that lucrative of a year. And you're not going to get that every year in the NFL draft.
Yeah. And that is definitely the case, is that you're going to have highs and lows with all of that. So based on what you've seen on tape, let's discuss some of these skill players.
And the other thing with that, though, real quick, Matt, is I think we've been spoiled. And when you have really deep drafts, you almost set a precedent that that's kind of the process. And every year you aren't going to get those five first-round quarterbacks. And this year you just don't have a lot of 220-pound running backs in the draft like you did last year. So it almost sets a dangerous precedent for fans to expect a very deep and kind of lucrative draft at every position every year.
No, that's a good point, Ben. And it's funny because what ends up happening too sometimes is that we can often be wrong about a class and have it be a little stronger, or some people will be wrong about a class and of a position and it'd be a little stronger. And then that sets the precedent, helps build the precedent of a class that is actually weaker as well. So it's not always what's hyped, but it can be what the result is. And also the result can be an early positive, but not necessarily a long-term positive for a player.
Exactly. And I'm sure everything I'm saying is going to be the exact opposite. So make sure you're putting little asterisks near all these.
that's the nature of our jobs, isn't it, for us?
Right.
But yeah, I mean, let's talk about some of these players that, you know, at the skill positions. Let's just start off with quarterback. Who are some guys, you know, let's talk about maybe three guys from each of these positions. And, you know, start off with one, with a guy that you, you know, you feel like that you're interested, that you think they could develop in becoming a, you know, a quality player in the NFL, whether it's a starter, whether it's a contributor. That's up to you how you determine that.
Yeah, you know, I have three guys I wrote down here, all with different kind of college arcs and different acclimates and different skill sets. First, that's going to blow you away with his tools to work with, and quarterback coaches are going to want to get their hands on him, and that's Drew Locke from Missouri. This kid's probably got the strongest arm in the draft. He's a bit of a gamer. Some people want to compare him to a Patrick Mahomes because of the way he'd be creative outside the pocket. He's really tough. He'll take the ball and run with it as well and finish some runs. He's got really intriguing tools to work with. He just didn't put it all together in a consistent fashion at Missouri. I know his completion percentage increased each year. You can see the deep throws outside the numbers, the opposite hash out routes. He's got all the tools. He just really just needs to get more consistent as he grows. And if he gets with a really good quarterback coach, I could see him, you know, really being able to manage an offense at the next level.
That's cool. Is there a team or a set of teams that you think would be a particularly good fit for him?
I could really see the Denver Broncos going and getting this guy and maybe playing him behind Case Keenum for a year and him being the quarterback of the future for John Elway and those Denver Broncos. But there's another quarterback that's kind of interesting toolsy-wise, and that's the grad transfer Gardner Minshew at Washington State. He's much more mobile and much more creative than these typical air raid quarterbacks that Mike Leach has coached. He's got some ability to move within the pocket, make some throws outside the pocket. I'm a little concerned because he's only about 6'1", 6'2". He's got a really good arm. He's got a quick release, and he anticipates really well. So he's going to be down at the Senior Bowl next week, which I think is a really big week for him to show he could take some drops from under center and handle an NFL-style offense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like those two names for sure. I think that Gardner Minshew shows some really good skill when it comes to working in and outside of structure.
Kyler Murray is the polarizing quarterback at this point in the process. There's no precedent for his size being 5'9", maybe 185 pounds. I saw him in person this year against Iowa State. He looked like he was about my size, which is about 5'10", 160 pounds. And I'm just really concerned that he's got to be able to make the timing, rhythm throws from the pocket that make offenses tick first and foremost. He's going to be the fastest guy in the field. He's going to have one of the strongest arms in the league. But you got to be able to operate the offense in a rhythmic fashion from the pocket first and foremost. Then you can be a dynamic athlete. Then you can work on the improvisational skills. He already does a really good job at protecting himself, getting out of bounds, sliding, shielding his shoulder away from contact, which he's going to have to do with that really slight frame. But there's no precedent for this style of player, and he's going to be a really polarizing player in this process.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's a player, there's probably about three No, that's not true. There's probably about six players that I haven't studied yet, and I tend to wait on quarterback until about this time of year to really review a lot of tape. But I've probably watched about 180, 85 players at this point. Murray, Haskins, those are two guys that I haven't seen yet. That I'm looking forward to watching. So that's going to be interesting from that standpoint. What about running back? You talked about there weren't a lot of guys in that 220 range, that you're looking at as maybe every down starters or feature backs. But who are some guys that intrigue you?
Yeah, Zach Moss at Utah was one of the more intriguing 220-pounders. He's going back to school. The Nebraska kids having a really good week at the Shrine Game. But some of the other top running backs, Josh Jacobs out of Alabama, he just doesn't have a lot of tread, doesn't have a lot of on-field experience. Damian Harris, a lot of experience, but he's not flashy. So people are kind of concerned on what his upside is. Bryce Love, 2,000 yards at Stanford last year, but he's about 195 pounds coming off an ACL. Same thing with Rodney Anderson, Oklahoma, coming off an injury. So all these top running backs kind of have some question marks, and they're going to really have to be poked and prodded. But I'm really interested in this David Montgomery kid from Iowa State. Extremely productive player, broke tons of tackles in his three-year career there. He's very similar to Saquon Barkley, and obviously Saquon's a freak talent. But in their play style, and that they're a run-to-daylight style of running back, they're really good at making that first guy miss, but there's a lot of tackles for loss. There's a lot of unnecessary kind of plays being blown up in the backfield, and there's just an unwillingness to stick his nose in for those tough yards. So there's a lot of highlight runs, but for every highlight run, there's about five runs of duds. So there's a big question on if he could kind of be managed into a more pro-style system and really be an efficient runner between the tackles. That's David Montgomery out of Iowa State. There's some intriguing guys as well. I really like this James Williams kid out of Washington State. He's only about 5'11", 200 pounds. He just broke the Pac-12 reception record that stood since 1985. was nothing that guys like Christian McCaffrey or anybody like that broke. But James Williams did, and he can really catch the ball out of the backfield. He's a bit undersized, but if you could prove to catch that ball out of the backfield and have a value on third down, I think NFL offenses really covet that position. And just some interesting late-round guys, whether it's Devin Singletary out of Florida Atlantic, who has 3,200 yards over the past 2 years, or this junior Dexter Williams out of Notre Dame that's really starting to build some tread ever since he got on the field. There's some interesting mid-round guys. It's just not a top-heavy running back group.
Yeah, I mean, I'll mention a few guys that I like as well that have kind of caught mine. You know, to begin with, yeah, certainly Montgomery is a fun one, and he's worth discussing. I think you covered him well. Bruce Anderson, who's going to be at the Senior Bowl in North Dakota State, you know, watching him at 5'11", 210, I really like how he catches the ball out of the backfield. They send him on a lot of, you know, seam routes, bullet routes, wheel routes.
He gets those running backs vertical at North Dakota State.
Yeah, they sure do. And but he can also run a variety of style of blocking blocking schemes, and he does that pretty well. I think he shows pretty good patience. He's has fantastic ball security, and I want to see just how explosive he really is up close. Then Alexander Mattison is a favorite of mine. The kid out of Boise State, 5'11", 211. I think he can be equally good in a gap or zone attack. I think he has strong decision-making processing skills from the in the way that his eyes and feet tie together well, you know, working through or anticipating penetration in the backfield and being able to find solutions that are efficient. He kind of reminds me a little bit in style to Ryan Williams, the former Virginia Tech running back.
Sure.
You know, so he's a guy that another one that I really like. And then a late round guy that just intrigues me is also another 211 pounder, but he's about 5'9", and he's out of Wyoming, and it's Nico Evans, who I'm, you know, when I've seen him, I've seen some flashes of skills that I'd like to see again, also how explosive he actually is. You know, I was actually kind of a Brian Hill fan out of Wyoming, and he had some decent showings late this year when he finally bounced back into Atlanta, but he seemed to be the kind of back that you know, he started in Atlanta, got cut, ended up, you know, with Cincinnati, and then ended up getting cut and ended up back in Atlanta. And he kind of, there are some backs, as you know, that they probably need to get into a rhythm and need some time on the field in order to actually show what they can do. And in the NFL, there's usually not a lot of time to say, let's give you, you know, half a dozen carries to see if you can get warmed up and get into this. But when you're a young player, sometimes your confidence level is lagging and you can't turn it on right away. And I think that Hill was kind of that way. And I'm kind of interested to see if Evans follows suit, or Evans is a guy that I think he runs smart, he runs hard, and he has some nice balance to him. So I just want to see how he stacks up athletically. And a last guy I'd say is Jalen Moore out of Appalachian State is another one that's a fun player who I think that might be able to provide that kind of spark to a backfield as a situational contributor.
Yeah, that's a really good point about getting into a rhythm at the running back position, because it is such a field position. And, you know, that was kind of the struggle this year with rookie running back Josh Adams of the Philadelphia Eagles is, you know, he'd get a touch or two, and then they'd split some time in that backfield committee. And he really needed 5-6 touches in a row to get the speed of the game, to understand the flow of the linebackers, to kind of really get to a rhythm of the whole blocking scheme. But, yeah, Jalen Moore is a very exciting player. He was on the freak list in the summer, running like a 4.37 40 with a mind-boggling 11-1 broad jump, really explosive player. There's another two mid- to late-round guys that run much harder than their size, Caron Higdon at Michigan and Travion Williams at Texas A&M. I think they're two guys that are really going to make an offense happy when they grab them in the fourth or fifth rounds.
Yeah, those are some good picks. And I did love your reference to Dexter Williams, because I was very impressed with the way that Notre Dame runs the ball and some of the run schemes that they have, especially with him from shotgun or split flanking the quarterback. It requires a fairly good balance between patience and decisiveness to be able to set up some of these runs where the blockers are pulling at the angles that they are. And I thought, you know, watching him against Stanford as a good example was a really nice game from him, where you saw that blend of patience and decision making and the footwork that he could use to really maximize those creases and spot them in the first place. So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned him. He's definitely a favorite of mine. How about wide receiver? Who are some guys on your list?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple superlative categories here. You know, we have our gadget type of receivers, and I think you can do it all. You can play them outside of the numbers. You play them in the slot. You want to get the ball in their hand. And there's kind of three different tiers I have. I really like Deebo Samuel out of South Carolina. Came off a serious injury in 2017. I saw him in person this year. This guy's got a running back type of body. It's rocked up. He's got a big bubble butt. He'll return kicks for you. He'll even do some punt gunning for you. He'll run the ball. He's throwing some touchdowns. He's a guy you just want on your team as a gadget to work with on the offense. Another interesting player is Paris Campbell out of Ohio State. He's a very raw receiver, but he's got the track speed. He's a guy you just want to get on double moves. You want to get him some jet sweeps and some orbit motions. Just get the ball in his hands and let him be a track star. His route running still needs a lot of work, especially getting up to the speed of an NFL route tree. And then the late round guy is this Mecole Hardman out of Georgia, who we seem to see every week on the SEC games having these big plays. He's really undersized, only about 5'11", 180 pounds, but possibly the fastest player in college football that I could see a team taking a waiver on the late rounds just to get that speed in the offense.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Paris Campbell's interesting to me because he's a guy that I watched once again last night. And you know, the types of routes that he runs and or what he's asked to do may be more limited than what he's going to be asked to do in the NFL, obviously. But what he, you know, some of the things that he did well, you could see some of the promise there in addition to that athletic ability. You know, watching him run a burst corner route and seeing that, you know, kind of how he hit those angles of that burst corner route, I thought was very good. And he was able to run that at a speed that kind of put the cornerback off or the defensive back off balance.
And like when I would see a nice route from him, he'd be clunky in tracking the ball. And it's like just when he would do something well as a receiver, there'd be an area of, you know, a receiver kind of trait that he still needed to improve on.
Yes. And that's what's funny about these things. I mean, you know, you look at guys who are very athletic and you wonder how much are they going to learn that? How are they and how good are they going to be at certain areas? Like who's a guy that was on the freak list that was the Auburn kid who played for the Steelers and then has been with the Texans at least.
Sammy Coates.
Yeah, Sammy Coates. You know, freak list extraordinaire. But, you know, I remember talking with a scout a couple years ago and he said, I'd just like to see someone actually throw the ball up in the air and, you know, and do an simple exercise of him tracking the ball. Because I think at that point, that's all you're going to need to see is like, and, you know, he was being facetious to an extent about that. You know, he's exaggerating a bit, but he said basically that was going to tell you where his biggest flaw was, which was tracking the football. So some of these guys, it's fascinating to see, you know, what pops off. And, you know, again, you know, are we going to be able to see a guy who can be smooth when it comes to bringing the ball in? You know, some guys that interest me, I mean, I would say Tyree Brady interests me. He's a player, the kid out of Marshall, 6'208". I think he's very smooth. I think that he showed some toughness against North Carolina State last year, I believe, just watching him kind of get banged up a little bit and take some physical play and had to leave the field, but came back immediately, faced the same guy, dealt with a physical situation and overcame it. And when I watch his game, I think he's got some refinement there, but he has room where he can continue to grow. And I like that about his game. You know, another one who is interesting to me is Preston Williams, the former Tennessee receiver at 6'4", 210 out of Colorado State. And he's got that fluid kind of, you know, I'm not comparing him directly, but he's kind of got that fluid AJ Green kind of build where you can see him add on a little bit more weight, but he's got that flexible frame. And I like that kind of maneuverable, mobile, flexible frame in wide receivers who can play, you know, maybe an X role. And, you know, the other guy on the other end of that spectrum might be Justin Hunter, who didn't quite have the career, but you can see Williams make some tough plays. He's good after the catch. I see him being able to work through contact and make people miss and set people up. And I think that there's some growth potential there. And a guy that I've been fascinated with since last year, who I just can't get enough film on right now, but I'd love to see some in the senior year, and I'm going to have to figure out a way to do that, is a small school kid out of Northern Arizona, Emmanuel Butler, 6'3", 220, who I thought his ability to go up and win the ball, you know, above the rim was just fantastic. The confidence that he had to do that against double teams. He was just a strong player who I saw repeatedly track the ball at a high level, whether it was on the move, in the middle of the field, on fade routes, on jump ball situations. And I just want to see, I kind of want to get an idea of really how athletic he is. Does he have enough of that short area quickness and acceleration to ride the ride in the NFL? Because if he does, I think he could be a surprisingly good player. So I, you know, that's a guy that I haven't seen enough of since last year. And, you know, I know that in the next month and a half, I'm going to be doing some digging to see if I can get my hands on as much tape as possible.
Yeah, this is a great part about just talking the draft, is just this time of the year, there's so many prospects, so many names. Emmanuel Butler was a guy I really haven't even heard of at this point, so adding him to my list. I'm glad you brought up Tyree Brady, who is a Miami transfer. And anytime you get those kids from South Florida, they just move at a different speed than everybody else, and they have that South Florida kind of wheels to them. So I'm really glad you mentioned him. There's two guys that I think are a bit underrated at this point in the process. There's one that you're going to have you're going to be like, whoa, this guy's underrated, but hear me out. Hakeem Butler out of Iowa State. Obviously, everybody knows about this kid now. He's 6'6", 225, was on the freak list, makes all sorts of plays at the catch point, after the catch. He's a tall glass of water. But a lot of people have concerns about his route running, and I think he's a much, much, much better route runner than people are giving him credit for. And when you put on his 2017 tape, when he ran a lot of his routes over the middle of the field with Alan Lazard being the outside receiver, he ran a lot more tight end style routes, a lot of sticks, a lot of seams, a lot of speed outs, a lot of double moves. But I thought he did a really good job getting in and out of his breaks. I thought he used his size really well to subtly push off. He's got the long arms, the catch radius. I thought he had the full package. And then seeing him this year, outside the numbers, putting up 10 plays of 40 yards, I really see a A.J. Green or a Plaxico Burress style of upside if he really starts to refine his game.
What's funny is, if anyone, those who follow me regularly will think that I paid you to say that, because Hakeem Butler is probably in my top 3 to 5 receivers at this point in terms of what I've graded thus far. So things can change, but he's graded out fairly high for me relative to this class. And for those exact reasons, and early this morning, I was watching another game of his against Iowa, and he ran a whip route, and he ran it so well that the cornerback had to basically interfere with him and try and tackle him to prevent a touchdown. Because
he moves really well. He's got good double moves. He sells his routes well. He can speed cut, which is very hard to do at 6'5", 6'6".
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. So I'm totally with you. I think he's a complete package. I think that he's an excellent player who's actually being underrated. And I can think of a number of teams that would be thrilled if they got the player that we think we're seeing, you know. So that's definitely a guy on that list. You know, I think another one that would be, you know, some other guys that I think might be fun to mention, just a late round guy that intrigues me, is out in my neck of the woods, out of Georgia State, Penny Hart.
All right, I'm on my list here.
See, there you go. 5'8", 180. And he's a guy that I think is going to be at the Senior Bowl.
Yeah, he was a late add. He got added last week. Yep.
Yeah, he's kind of got that Richie James, Trent Taylor kind of vibe in terms of what he can offer. Very quick. And you can see that quickness in his routes after the catch. And he's someone that tracks and snatches the ball really well. And I've seen him run enough routes that, like, some of the plays that really impressed me, I was watching freshman tape. And I was thinking, wow, this kid is... This kid's plays with a lot of confidence, and they're using him in a variety of ranges of the field early on. They used him a lot out of the backfield, but they also used him in the slot and occasionally used him outside if they could get a type of coverage that they felt that he would manage pretty well.
Yeah.
And
I would hit his wheel. I wrote down Taylor Gabriel just after seeing the size, number 18.
Yes.
I thought they moved the same way, but And as I was watching Penny Hart, I see a much more refined and polished route runner. He's not just a speed demon. I think he has some pretty sharp stems and some really clever releases. He knows how to attack the leverage and the blind spots to get where he's going. I think Taylor Gabriel is a little bit more of a speed demon deep threat. I think this guy is a much more complete package.
Yeah, I agree. And he's a guy that's pretty high on my list, you know, relative to, you know, the 80, you know, I don't know how many I've watched. How many guys have yeah, about the 80 plus receivers I've watched this far. So he's pretty high up there. He's in, you know, he's got to be in that, you know, top quarter, you know, of players.
I still have concerns about throwing to a 5'8 receiver outside the numbers. And I know a lot of people are pounding the table for Andy Isabella and saying he's not your typical 5'9 white slot receiver. He could win outside the numbers, but just not having that length and that size outside the numbers against these 6'6", 6'2" cornerbacks in the NFL, it's very, very tough. And, you know, I saw the Rams try to play Tavon Austin out there for 5 and 6 years and throw him verticals, you know, week in and week out. And just, it's really tough to survive at that size outside the numbers.
It is. And sometimes it's just tough for the quarterback to be able to hit a guy outside the numbers with that height, where a guy who's, you know, 6 to 8 inches taller can actually, you know, be an asset for a ball that isn't pinpointed.
Yeah,
so
you start talking about wingspan, you start talking about inches on both sides of your arms, becomes a much larger target for the quarterback, or lack thereof, if it's a smaller player. Right.
Yeah, I have one more player that kind of interests me, who I saw for the first time last night. He's a small school guy. Xavier Ubosi, who is from UAB. He's 6'3", 218, and I was really impressed with how he could drop his weight into hard breaks, gets his head around quickly. He attacked the football consistently, even on routes where he was targeted in that waist to chest area, where a lot of receivers initially overthink it, and then next thing you know, they've got their one hand in one position and the other in the other, and they're trying to gator clap the ball and ends up bouncing off their chest. This is a guy that had his hand position uniform, was confident about being able to make the catch. He was beating people left and right on vertical routes. Now, it was Northern Illinois who he was facing in terms of some of the players there. But, you know, watching that game, I was impressed with what I saw of a guy who I had never even heard of until last night. And he kind of reminded me in build of Michael Thomas and some of the way that he moved into breaks, the way Michael Thomas would do and the way he was coached up at Ohio State. And now I'm just talking stylistically, not talent, you know, but he's a guy that's definitely worth watching, because 6'3", 218, you know, very thick legged, you know, big bubbled type of guy with some speed and look fluid.
Yeah. He's been on my list. I haven't watched him yet, but anytime a guy has nearly a 24 yard catch average on 35 catches with 8 touchdowns and you see the size, that's definitely an intriguing player. And one last guy to throw in there that won't wow you in any regard, but Keyshawn Johnson, that's K-E-E Sean Johnson, not K-E-Y, from Fresno State. This guy's going to run 4.6 at the combine, but he's an absolute technician. He has great hands, great routes. I think he's the all-time leading receiver in the Mountain West. He broke all Devontae Adams records. They went to the same high school. He's turning a lot of heads at the Shrine Week in his practices, carving up corners and one-on-ones, but he's not going to do anything flashy. But I think he's just a really solid possession receiver, and I mean that in an endearing way. I know possession receiver sometimes is a negative.
Yeah, but hey, you know what? I hear that about Keenan McCardell back in the day, and if when I think of a possession receiver, I think of Keenan McCardell, and I go, if that's a bad word, then I want it. I want that bad word.
Reason, but.
Yeah. How about tight end? Let's wrap this up with that. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people who talk about this tight end class as being actually very strong up at the top. Where is that, because they're thinking from a fantasy perspective of these guys potentially being receivers who might get high volume one day? Or is it something else that you think, or what do you think about this class and some of the guys that intrigue you from it?
You know, I wouldn't be shocked if no tight ends get taken in the first round. I think there's some intriguing players that you get a little too excited about. Yeah, Noah Fant's very interesting in the pass game. We all saw Irv Smith Jr. at Alabama perform in some big games. I think you get excited, and everybody wants that next Zach Ertz or that Rob Gronkowski or Travis Kelce, and thinking that that's a big position in NFL offenses, they're going to go get that guy. But the NFL has proven they don't overdraft tight ends. And if O.J. Howard's going in the middle of the first round, you know, Joku's going in the back of the first round, Evan Ingram's kind of late, I just don't see them reaching for these tight end style players, even if they are, you know, dangerous threats in the pass game, or whether they're guys you could put in line and they're blockers. I just don't see the NFL really coveting this position and then going to overdraft guys in the first round.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that that's a realistic look of, you know, compared to what you see from a lot of, you know, our brethren on social media who, you know, are drumming up excitement. And they may be excited also on, you know, obviously because of what they've watched. There's certainly a few guys on that list, and you mentioned at least one of them that I was, you know, that I certainly find exciting when I watch him play and the possibilities, but I couldn't agree with you more about just the draft history and also the position takes time to develop. I mean, it's one of the most difficult offensive positions to play because the blocking element is such a higher degree of difficulty in the NFL game than it is in the college game, especially for the tight end. So, you know, that plus route adjustments, hops, you know, things that they have to work on from that standpoint. Yeah. It's to me, it's a 2 to 3 year position often.
Yeah. And I love looking at the case from a couple of years ago when everybody was excited about Max Williams out of Minnesota and he looked like this dangerous pass catching threat and dangerous in the open field. And they take this guy, Nick Boyle, out of Delaware in the fourth or fifth round. And suddenly Nick Boyle is getting snaps over Max Williams. Why? Because Nick Boyle was a better football player than Max Williams was.
Yeah, there you go. So who are some of the guys that do intrigue you with this class?
I'll kind of split this up with some pass catchers and some blockers. Everyone knows about Noah Fant, the athletic pass-catching tight end. He's got an angular build. He's got speed, vertical speed, runs good routes. He's going to test like a Jared Cook and run 4.5 at 240 pounds. He's really exciting. If there's an offense that feels like all they need is that one dynamic pass-catching threat over the middle of the field, whether it's a Green Bay, they have two first-round picks. I could see them maybe going after it with their second one. But there's some intriguing guys later on. You have Jay Sternberger, the Kansas transfer at Texas A&M. I did a game of his this year where Mississippi State defensive coordinator Bob Shoup said he was like Zach Ertz. This is the number one guy we have to stop on this team. Had a bit of a clunky game, a couple drops, but he's still a tall glass of water, kind of that oversized receiver, move tight end like a Zach Ertz or a Tyler Eifert. But for every one of those guys you get excited about early on, there's the Josh Olivers from San Jose State or Dax Raymond out of Utah State that you could probably get in the, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth round on day three that are really tall players that have good hands, that have good size, just enough speed to threaten linebackers and safeties that you don't necessarily need to reach for a guy on day one or day two. Josh Oliver and Dax Raymond, I think, are both headed to the Senior Bowl next week. Big weeks for them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think I'm most excited about the other Iowa tight end, T.J. Hockenson.
Oh, he's fun.
He is fun. And I know a lot of people are like, he's George Kittle, you know, Jr. He's the next George Kittle, you know. And certainly, you know, he shows a lot as a blocker. He's a fluid receiver. I think he's gotten even more fluid as the time has gone on. I've been told by someone who's close to staff that they had him watch a lot of Rob Gronkowski over the summer, and he did pick up a couple of things that were helpful that helped his game as a receiver and after the catch. He reminds me a little bit of Dennis Pitta, you know, like I was a big Dennis Pitta fan in that same class with Gronkowski, and, you know, the way he moved, just the way that he could block, the savvy in which he was able to find and create space, whether it was as a blocker in the run game or a receiver route runner. You mentioned Sternberger, and I certainly find him intriguing after watching a few of his games. You know, a guy that I would say that I want to watch. I wasn't as intrigued with Fant, to be honest with you. Like Fant, I think Fant fights the ball a little too much, so I'm a little worried about him. I think he can be good as an athlete, as a receiver, and I think the Jared Cook reference is quite apt, you know, in that level. And it might even be apt for, you know, fighting the ball a little bit early on in his career before he gets things a little bit more uniform. You know, two guys that I'll just mention who probably are, you know, later round guys. And I'm just, you know, I don't know if they've got it to put it together, but I want to see how they perform in a camp, you know, as an undrafted invite or a late round pick. Is Tommy Sweeney out of Boston College, yeah, the 6'5", 260 guy. Yeah. You know, so there's some fluidity to him. I think that he's a good football player overall. And Keenan Brown out of Texas State, who used to be with Oklahoma State, you know, kind of in that oversized receiver mode in terms of 250, but more like 6'3". But there's just a fluidity in how he moves and that mobility as an athlete and ability to catch the ball and track it, I thought were pretty good. So I'd like to see how he would do as a blocker, because I don't know if he's been called upon to do that as much. You know, I've seen a few things with him, but I want to see a little bit more. And that's a part of his game that I'm still exploring.
Yeah, you know, just going back to Noah Fant, my one real area of concern is I need my tight end to be a good jump receiver. What I mean by that is you got to make the tough catches in tight windows with a linebacker on your back. And, yeah, he's exciting when you get him into the open spaces on double moves and outside the numbers. But first and foremost, I need you to make those tight window throws, those junk receptions over the middle. And I'm not sure that's his skill set, first and foremost.
Yeah. Listen, go ahead.
And there's the other area, like I was saying, how those Nick Boyle sometimes get put on the field over the Max Williams of the world. I have a couple guys in that category. Tommy Sweeney was one of them, as they're not really featured in that Boston College offense. There's other guys that really aren't featured in the offense, but are solid, well-rounded football players, whether that's Foster Moreau at LSU, who they never throw to their tight ends down there, or Matt Sokol at Michigan State. This guy's like 6'6", 6'7", about 265 pounds. He looks like an extra tackle. He's a really good inline blocker. I get to see these guys with good size, good acclimate, good point of attack blockers that, you know, can really sink their hips and play with some leverage. I can see these guys getting on the field first and foremost because they're better football players at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely a great point. So, you know, you talked about, you know, before we wrap this up, it's kind of a bonus question, is you talked about things that you had the opportunity, you know, to learn from guys like Mayock and Davis and, you know, Daniel Jeremiah, Matt Millen. You know, is there anything that comes to mind? I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but anything that comes to mind about learning about the game or learning about doing what you do that might be helpful to people who listen to this podcast? Because, you know, this podcast often delves into the details of, you know, my journey as an evaluator and other people's journey as they're evaluating when they're guests. So I'd love to have you share with them kind of some things that maybe you got from those guys, even if it seems obvious. But, you know, oftentimes when you get into a position to talk with somebody on this level, oftentimes it's confirmation of things that you thought, but you might not have been totally sure until you observed them or talked to them.
Yeah, so there's kind of a lot there, but, you know, just very generally and first and foremost with this, what I learned from a lot of these guys is football and the study of football is nothing you can just put all the materials in a room, spend hours and hours and days and weeks and months and years with all those materials and come out an expert. It's not how the game works. You don't know what you don't know. And I think perspective in football is so important. And that's why I think it's, you have to have that balance of sharing your mind and sharing your time with other people. Because if you don't do that, you'll never know those other perspectives or how somebody else saw the game. And, you know, football is a beautiful kind of opera and orchestra of 22 moving parts. And there's all different positions and skill sets and responsibilities that if you don't know, you really don't know. And it's very fascinating to look at a game a certain way and then to talk with somebody else and they see it completely different. And I think that's a beautiful aspect of football and why there's so much room for analysis is you can look at one play 20 different times and talk about 20 different things. And I think it's just very important to surround yourself with other minds. And obviously, I've been privileged to surround myself with some very credible minds that have played this game, have coached it, that have spent a lot of time as well. And as you're around those people, you'll realize they're so willing to give back as well because they didn't get to where they were going on their own as well. But as you're studying football and become more ingrained in football, you'll realize football is everywhere. And there's so many materials out there, from books to make yourself more educated, to clinics out there, whether it's clinic videos on YouTube or actually attending clinics, or even just the game of football and understanding there's colleges everywhere, there's high schools everywhere, all sorts of different level, and all those programs have players, have coaches, have assistants. There's football everywhere. Just go find football and open your mind to different perspectives and ways of thinking, and that will deepen your knowledge of the game. You don't always have to agree with other people, but I think it's important to digest and analyze other perspectives, and you'll really open your eyes to how detailed this game is and how little you know. And if for every day of the week that I feel like I really have a grasp on this game, and then I go and talk to somebody else, or I go talk to a John DeFilippo, who was our quarterback coach in Philadelphia last year, and I have no idea what I don't know. And I think that's just a very important kind of concept, is the perspective of the game and understanding you don't know everything.
No, I think that's a healthy perspective. It's a great one. And it kind of fits something else that I was watching just off of this topic. You know, I was a musician in a former life, and one of the things that I was watching recently was of a music educator talking about a site that he started where he was working with a bunch of, you know, basically semi-professional, older jazz musicians, people who want to get back into improvising. And I've always often explored on this program the links between improvisational craft of music and the craft of playing football as a performance craft. That there are a lot of links to that. We've even had a show where I invited a former roommate of mine who's a professional trombonist in the jazz world and an educator and a football fan, and we talked about kind of the links between improvisational music and performing on a field and teamwork and how all and playing with a band and what all these types of things have in common and how you can see these links. And one of the things that this guy was talking about, the teacher, was that one of the things that you need to become a really strong performer is a community. You need to have a community around you, because you can't, like you just said, you can't learn it just in a room by yourself. You're only going to learn so much. And until you're able to share and have a you know, sharing of ideas, you're really not going to get a chance to really see it as fully dimensionally, and to explore even your ideas that you have to share to their fullest extent, because you're not going to come up with the questions that other people do from their own experiences about what you see.
And there's so many different layers to that. I mean, there's the coaching side of it. There's the player evaluation side of it. You know, they each kind of take different forms. And as you become more confident in your football, you know, watching your football IQ, don't be afraid to reach out and go to that local high school in the summer and saying, hey, you mind watching tape, or can I hang out and watch practice? And to learn the different drills and techniques, and everybody's got different styles and approaches and the ways they handle and manage the game. It's just very fascinating, because there's no right or wrong way to do it. It's such a perspective-based kind of craft.
Yeah, man, absolutely. And you know, you, because of the fact that you delve into a lot of the X and O strategies, what's funny is, you know, from my angle, I started from really just my strength that I brought to beginning to develop a craft to someone evaluating was the process of evaluating from another area of training that I had. And then I could apply that, and it helped me get a start on being able to ask the right questions to help me learn what I don't know, and start reaching out to other people to find out what I needed to know and to how to frame questions and continue to work on that. But one of the things that I've been working on more and more over the years is the X's and O's, the structure, the theory of the game. And, you know, I found myself lately getting, you know, a whiteboard and literally just taking books and writing things down and trying to memorize how this is drawn up, how it looks on a board, you know, how it's run, what people are looking at, what, you know, from, you know, one of your expertise is the X's and O's. How would you recommend to someone like me to just go about learning that? What are some other ways? Do you like the idea of using a blackboard and playing the kind of the memorization game and the way people would diagram sentences when they, you know, back in the day, or or in addition to that, are there other things that you would recommend to someone?
Yeah, that's like actually one of the best ways to really absorb the game is what's called padding. And that's a term used in the, you know, the video rooms and the scouting rooms and the guys that break down the film of these teams each week. Padding is pretty much you're breaking down the entire game on a pad of paper. So you're drawing up almost every play by hand. And it's one of the best ways. It's very tedious. It's a long process, but it really allows you to kind of digest what you just saw by diagramming every play. And then you start to notice the trends and the recurring plays. And in the same way that in high school they said, hey, if you rewrite your notes, you tend to absorb it a little bit more. The padding process, I've heard, it's very tedious. It gets very old. If you don't need to do it, it's very, you know, taxing and time consuming, but it's a great way to kind of absorb the game and just interpret it differently than just watching it with your eyes.
That makes sense. I mean, that's kind of how I learned with evaluation is I'd transcribe every play, what I saw, and I would write it down to a ridiculous degree. But after about, 10 years of doing that every year and writing thousands of pages worth of information about prospects, you start to get very familiar with what the things you're observing. It becomes secondhand, and it gets under your fingers. So I'm glad to hear that, because that's probably the next process that I'll probably be starting on over the next 10 years is doing as much padding as possible when I can make the time.
Yeah, so. And just full disclosure, I mean, I stopped playing football after eighth grade. I'm short, white kid. I stopped being able to throw over the line. I'm a better golfer. So I was never, and I went to a college without a football team. So I was never involved with the day-to-day, week-to-week game planning and execution in the integral kind of workings of football teams. So the whole padding process was something new to me that Mike Mayock introduced. And that's the same thing about perspective, in that you don't know some of these processes unless you get out there and meet some people and get into some rooms and talk to some coaches and figure out how they do it. And I like to equate a lot of things to golf, as I was a golfer and never had a lesson in my life. I'm a guy that I just want to sit at the driving range and I'll figure it out. And I was really struggling one summer. I couldn't get rid of this slice. The guy was watching my swing from afar and said, hey, why don't you just do this with your front toe? And fixed it for the whole year. And it was just sometimes you can't just sit by yourself and come out an expert. And you need that kind of extra perspective, that extra eyes to see other processes and other thought processes to really, help you on your way.
Yeah. And I think for anyone who had a chance to listen to Ben today, I think you'll know that you should be following him and he will help you get on your way with wanting to learn and enjoy the game a lot more. You can definitely find Ben Fennell at at Ben_Fennell_NFL. And that's his Twitter ad. You can find that there. And again, you can, he's a contributor to The Athletic Wisconsin, NFL Draft with the NFL Network, Eagles Game Plan, and then ESPN College Football and Game X's and O's. And, we'll forgive him for the fact that he went to Drexel and didn't have a real football team. So, but seriously, thank you, Ben, for being on. This was a fantastic episode and I appreciate you taking the time out.
Absolutely. A pleasure hopping on and talking ball with you anytime.
Oh, great. So listen, folks, I hope you guys have had a great new year. Senior Bowl's coming up. You'll be hearing, if you're subscribed to the RSP cast, you'll be able to hear, updates about practices, and I'll have a number of people on, probably ranging from Mark Schofield to John Owning to Cecil Lammy and Gene Bramall and a variety of other guests who will probably be, surprise folks that I'll wrangle in to talk a little shop about practices and players. You can subscribe to the RSP cast if you're new to this on iTunes, Google Play, and Blueberry and Stitcher. Please rate and review. And of course, the RSP publication is available April 1st. You can buy a login and password in advance, pre-order at the site, www.mattwaldmanrsp.com. And also take a look at the video preview or tour of the RSP and RSP post-draft package. If you have any questions about it, you can contact me at mattwaldmanrsp@gmail.com. Thanks again to our guest, Ben Fennell. And you guys have a good week.